I'm Jacob Gimmel, an audio engineer and musician. Creation has been such a huge element in my life, and I believe that everyone in the world should be able to create. This podcast will shine a spotlight on the stories of people in music. If you like this podcast and want to hear more, hit the subscribe button. Ken Ueno is a composer, vocalist, and sound artist. He's a recipient of the Rome Prize and the Berlin Prize. He's also a professor at UC Berkeley, where he holds the Jerry and Evelyn Hemmings Chambers Distinguished Professor Chair in Music. And he's been critically recognized as an important contributor to the arts. Ken has done a variety of sound art installations that have helped us understand the world in a different kind of way. It's sometimes hard to transcend barriers or formats, but I feel like Ken's art exists like it's in your space. He talks about his musical roots, and I begin to understand why his art has this kind of feel to it. He comes across as a really thoughtful, humble artist. This is Ken.
There are two histories, actually. One, this is Plan B. I had a complicated childhood. I was born in New York, but my family, when I was 8 months old, we moved to Japan and then to Switzerland. It was in Switzerland at the international school where I started to learn English, but most of my teachers were British. So initially when I was a kid, I had a British accent. And then we settled in LA. I didn't look like anybody else. I didn't sound like anybody else. And I also sounded different than the way they expected me to sound. So my whole life I was told that I was American. And I was trying to figure that out. And as a sensitive young person, I was trying to be like everyone else. It was troublesome. So I developed a plan to try to resolve this issue of identity. And so plan A was to work really hard and get a congressional nomination, get into West Point, serve my country, prove that I'm American, become a general, and come back to California and become a senator. I was interested in service as a way to prove that I was American. And along that journey, I had minimal musical training. I learned to play recorder in kindergarten, but it wasn't until much later, actually the year before I went to college. But let me first tell you what happened with my plans for West Point. I actually got into West Point and I went there. I survived the first year, the plebe year, which is still the hardest year of my life, knock on wood. And then going into the second year, West Point, I suffered an injury in a training accident and I couldn't continue anymore. And in fact, I had to leave West Point and come back home and convalesce for 2 years. Thankfully, though, the year before I went off to college, I discovered the electric guitar, discovered Jimi Hendrix, and I was just so blown away by it that I just had to start playing electric guitar, right? And so 2 years later, during the period of my convalescence for 2 years, all I did was go to physical therapy and play guitar 8-9 hours a day. Eventually, I started writing some songs and playing in bands. And when I got healthy enough to think about finishing my education, somehow I got it in my head, well, I got most of my general eds out of the way with 27 credits per semester at West Point, as well as AP credits. And I thought, well, maybe I could do music. I didn't know what that would entail, really. At that point, I think I'd even only heard of schools like Juilliard, Chris Early. I knew I couldn't go there because I was playing heavy metal at the time. But I found a school in Boston called the Berklee College of Music, where they had typically have like 800 guitarists. You know, and around that time, I was also beginning to learn about jazz and was getting interested in learning to play jazz. So I thought, maybe I'll give that a shot. Yeah. That's what I did. And like every music student in the world, I took a required course in music history, which is actually the history of Western classical music. When we get to the 20th century, I was introduced to Bartok's string quartets, and that was a very profound revelation to me. It was very visceral, like heavy metal. So I thought it was classical music, but the power of it, the visceral power of it, I could relate to, you know, from rock and heavy metal. It had that kind of energy. But there was also this complexity about the structure, and there's something on the score that I had an allure. I wanted to reverse engineer it, and that's how I became a composer. And then I thought, oh, I'll try to stay in graduate school for as long as I could. I knew I had to, not growing up with classical music, I needed lots of time to kind of catch up and lock myself in a library, look at scores, get to know the repertoire, and just study up, right? And around that time, in my mid-20s, I was also introduced to throat singing. And I was blown away by that too. Wow, that's amazing. Just had a similar allure to the magic that Jimi Hendrix had. Like, wow, it's so cool. I just have to feel like I do it. I want to do it. You know, so I started practicing. And then after a while, I started performing with my voice. And at the same time, I was writing pieces for chamber music, orchestra. And about 10 years later, I had an opportunity to write for myself. Well, in the meantime, I had led it like a double life, right? Writing music for classically trained musicians to perform, as well as also performing with my voice. And then eventually I had this opportunity to try to bring those worlds together, writing a concerto for myself. Around that time, I rediscovered these cassette tapes I made when I was 6. And I was recording sounds I was making with I was taking my mini cars and rubbing it against the microphone and crinkling paper, recording things like my mom yelling at my brother. I was also vocalizing, and it turns out I was singing multiphonics. So maybe when I heard throat singing as an adult, I was predisposed to it subconsciously. I had forgotten it, you know? And now I think maybe my first real instrument was the tape recorder and my voice. So that's how I say maybe this one history going forward linearly, but another trying to reclaim or remember the thing I was just doing naturally as a kid.
As I examine Ken's story, I begin to understand his art more. Ken and I grew up differently. We both moved around, but Ken felt like he sounded and looked different. He had the desire to fit in. I felt like I looked like everybody else. There were these preconceived notions about the boy that I was, and I always wanted to be perceived as different. I wanted people to embrace me regardless of the difference. In search of identity, Ken and I were coming from different places, but our search was about many of the same things. Ken's trajectory into music is very much opposite to how many musicians go into it. Many look at desk jobs or the military as a fallback in case the music thing doesn't pan out. But Ken's military path seemed to come to an end and pushed him into music. Artists like Ken are who we need to listen to right now during this pivotal time. Perhaps their path will help us in the fight for a brighter future. How did you find your identity in classical music?
Initially, I was just pursuing something that seemed kind of shiny. You know, it's like, oh, that's just like candy or something. I wanted to do that. I wanted to pursue it. I didn't really have an idea of even initially trying to carve out a space for myself. And then as I got more experienced, I started, I had some initial crises, you know. One, I started realizing that all of the references that we were being taught, the models of being a composer were essentially mainly German. And I thought, like, wow, the whole history of classical music is so dominated by German culture, all of these great composers. None of these models look like me. How can I? Can I be a composer? How do I belong? And then around that time, also being a fan of film, I discovered the works of Wim Wenders, a German filmmaker. And I started becoming a fan. I got interview books, essays. In one of the interviews, he says that growing up in Germany in the 50s, he felt, you know, colonized by American culture. You know, American soldiers were occupying Germany. He was listening to rock and roll. And then he thought the history of cinema was dominated by Hollywood, and him as a German person had this insecurity of, like, can I, you know, continue making cinema when I don't belong to the dominant culture? And those are his words. And then he said he discovered the only real master, Yasujiro Ozu, this Japanese director who had been working from the silent period into the color period. And I've gotten to know Ozu's works too. He's now one of my favorite directors as well. It's a very distinctive style, like nobody else. It's a very unique voice. And it was probably important for me to hear of an artist that I respected, whose narrative he shared kind of paralleled my experience, but in the converse. And he was a German person who found discovered kind of vindication and an agency or a license to go on, right, through discovering a Japanese master, and me being a Japanese American feeling insecure that I wasn't German, you know, and that was very helpful. But then since then, I've discovered some role models like Takemitsu, and I've been lucky to meet some role models like Paul Chihara, a great senior Japanese-American composer, and people like Chinnery Ung, senior Asian-American composers. So I felt a little bit less lonely.
How did you find purpose and belonging in making art?
What I realized is that when I was young, I didn't have mentors, you know, and as a young person planning to go to college and trying to develop a life plan and feeling this crisis of identity, I was naive. And I thought by putting on a uniform and serving my country, people would, of course, accept me, right? There is no guarantee about how people will accept you, no matter what uniform you wear or how you, because I still have this color of skin and face, and depending on how other people feel about what my face signifies, I can't control that. I've also found out, no matter what I've accomplished or what I've become, some people will still judge me for that. I can't, so I shouldn't cater to that. All I can do is try to work on myself. And art has taught me, it has given me a space to just work on myself, essentially. And maybe that's all we can do, all of us, essentially, really, right? And by imagining something fantastic, trying, and even when I fail, the fact that I was able to enact something that started in my imagination has emboldened myself, my state of being, and given me more confidence about some sort of sense of agency. So that's what I want to stand for, that you know, through our creative imaginations, and then essentially, you know, the transformation from imagining to doing is a changing of the world, you know. Imagining artworks that happen like a year from now, right? And working hard to do that in our small ways. It's a model for how we can change the world. Yeah. And that with each project, there's a growing, space that I know I've made for myself, and that emboldens me, gives me more confidence. So that's what I appreciate from this life that I've been able to lead.
Through my own experiences, I've learned that I have internalized aspects of a narrative that are often based on unfair stereotypes and hold no actual weight. I always feel like I'm on the right team, and yet I'm oblivious to the dangers of mismanaging and not challenging these subtle stereotypes and the effect that they have on people. What advice do you have for people who want to help out, but they may or may not know how?
We all need to work together. So if you have an inkling about some other people's concerns, not just in music, I think we all need allies, right? So exactly like what we're doing today, you've given me space to talk and us to talk together, right? That's a great big step. And then so I would encourage your listeners to talk to us. Yeah. And then we could also suggest, depending on how involved people want to get, to be educated, readings and listenings and other kind of thing, and participate. Yeah, but it does take bandwidth, to be an ally, right? I recognize we all have to choose the things that we that matter to us, and what sectors of our society and cultures matter enough that we want to help others. But it is true that many people who are most comfortable, maybe, are not thinking about helping others or helping to create other, expand the space for other people, But I think it's inevitable that all sectors of our society in the United States that we need to move towards being more empathic in all sectors, right? Mm-hmm. There's a great bifurcation of inequality of the wealth gap, for example.
Yeah,
and it's moving towards a point that is not going to be sustainable, and the pandemic is bringing all of these issues to light.
Let's talk about that for a second. The pandemic has affected everybody. And I'm hoping this podcast will be out there even past the pandemic. But how has the pandemic affected the arts?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, classical music, most of the events have been canceled. And So many of my colleagues, their livelihoods, especially if they're freelancers, have been totally wiped out. And if you're a freelancer, you don't have insurance. Especially my colleagues who are younger, they might have played in 3 to 5 different orchestras and or had like adjunct teaching positions, and
that's also a problem
in America, like how our health insurance is usually attached to a primary, you know, job, right, with benefits. And if you're patching together lots of freelance gigs, yeah, might be able to make rent if all is going well. But if that's wiped out too, not only is making rent difficult, but in this health crisis, many of our colleagues don't have health insurance. Yeah, and compared to other first world nations, right? It's shocking, the comparison to,
you know, people are,
our colleagues in East Asia and Europe, where they have universal healthcare. They don't, you know, at least if they're during this pandemic, they know they could get healthcare. You know, if they become sick, they can count on that. And that there are also some social services when they might not have work for a certain period. So I know in the United States,
we could do better.
You know, it's got to start with more of us caring about more of us, right? It's because I think there's something about American exceptionalism. Of course, it's created. America's been so successful in producing amazing superstars, not only, you know, in all sectors of our world, like sports, music and culture, art, and the sciences, and so many sectors, so many remarkable people. American exceptionalism has worked on that aspect. But American exceptionalism, we forget, is a story of exceptionalism. There's 350 million of us, you know, and how many people actually play in the NBA? You know, the rest of us are not talented enough or whatever to get to the NBA, so to speak, right? So then where does this set up, you know, helps give a space for us to also live meaningful lives, and especially if there's a pandemic, right? Yeah. We could do better, I hope.
Are there any arts programs that you're aware of that are making a difference, that have a sense of urgency with funding?
Yeah, I'm inspired by my colleague, Jennifer Koh. She's a world-class violinist, and you know, she's a superstar. She goes around the world playing concertos. But she recognized that despite the fact that her livelihood has been compromised like the rest of us during this time, that the people who were suffering the most were our younger colleagues. So she created a program called Alone Together, in which she paired you know, more established composers with younger ones of their choosing. And then the idea is that the established composers donated pieces, which helped fund the commissions of the younger composers. And there were, in order to try to, shall we say, spread the wealth, they were micro commissions. They were like 1 minute pieces. But she helped raise with her arts organization, ARCO, commission funds for, you know, 20 young composers, each getting paid $500. So they sure people, and that also, yeah, so that had a direct impact in terms of you know, helping these young people at least try to make, you know, rent during this time, as well as bring attention to their work. And they were all, she also has a mission of supporting women and women composers and composers of color. So those were, so that's really targeting a demographic of people who have been marginalized within classical music, especially during the pandemic. And that was successful enough that it also became a model for some other classical music institutions to do similar commissions and diversity initiatives too. So that's I can point to that as something that's positive that came out of this. And I felt a kind of kinship to what Jennifer was doing with, you know, when I heard you talk about your podcast and people thinking outside of themselves. And even though we were all impacted and you're impacted, and that's what you told me was very, you know, powerful. But also within that space, to think about what you could do for others, you know, with this podcast. So those things give me more hope. Yeah.
Let's say this pandemic thing ends at some point. What would you like to envision the new and evolved arts community looking like?
Wow. Okay. A deeper understanding that support of art and culture is necessary, and necessary for a national identity too. Right, we've depended upon remarkable individuals, Elvis and, you know, Muddy Waters or whatever, right, to articulate American culture, and Michael Jackson. Sure, but there's more that we could all, as a country, support, and especially you know, young people. I see this in the university. We recently had a discussion in the humanities departments about how overall fewer and fewer young people are majoring in the humanities because there's so much more pressure to go into measures that articulate into vocational outcomes, right? Computer science, engineering, econ, and business, and sure. It's also contingent upon things that cost of living being so expensive. And so there's more pressure for young people to kind of design their lives with vocational, positive vocational outcomes. And also college education becoming so expensive, right? Those pressures ramp up this narrative. You major in something so that you can get a better job, right? And if there's a way we can reverse that trend, that you know, culture and education, humanities, that cultivate empathy and understanding is just as important. And that people need to have more confidence overall, that no matter what you study or who you are, that as an American, we'll be okay. I think that's one of the things, that if we could feel that confidence, then more people will pursue education and interests that are focused, that are centered on their heart's desire. And imagine a whole country of people who have pursued the things not because of primarily because of worrying about putting a roof over their heads and supporting their family, but because they want to be happy. And then I think if we can center happiness, then I can imagine a whole country of 350 million people getting along better. Yeah, that's a strategic kind of global hope. And I think locally and in smaller ways, there's other things we could do, you know, support the arts in our local communities, participating more, trying to give more space for different kinds of people and different kinds of arts that, you know, and everybody doing that can only make for a more equitable, safe space for everyone, right?
I think that... that's the future that I would want to see as well. And I think it will take a ton of effort. And at the same time, it's totally possible. We have the power. So thank you so much for your time. I hope that it will inspire us all to get to work. All right. Thanks again. I really appreciate talking with you.
It's great. Great pleasure meeting you a couple of weeks ago. Thanks for coming to my class, and thanks for having me on your show. It's a lot of fun talking to you, always. Yeah, thank you.
Next week, we'll be talking with Kyle Alexander, a music producer and life coach. If you like this podcast and want to hear more, go to jammingin.com and subscribe.